Lord Russell, what is philosophy?
Well, that's a very controversial question. I think no two philosophers will give you the same answer. My own view would be that philosophy consists of speculations about matters where exact knowledge is not yet possible. But that will only be my answer, not anybody else's.
What's the difference between philosophy and science?
Well, roughly you'd say science is what we know and philosophy is what we don't know. That's a simple definition. And for that reason, Christians are perpetually passing over from philosophy into science as knowledge advances.
Well, when something is established and discovered, it ceases to be philosophy and becomes science.
Yes. And all sorts of questions that used to be labeled philosophy are no longer so labeled.
Well, what good is philosophy?
I think philosophy has two uses, really. One of them is to keep alive speculation about things that are not yet amenable to scientific knowledge. After all, scientific knowledge covers a very small part of the things that interest mankind and ought to interest them. There are a great many things of immense interest about which science, at present at any rate, has nothing to say. And I don't want people's imaginations to be limited and enclosed within what can be now known. And I think to enlarge your imaginative purview of the world into the hypothetical realm is one of the uses of philosophy. But there's another use which I think is equally important, which is to show that there are things we thought we knew and don't know. On the one hand, to keep us thinking about things that we may come to know, and on the other hand, to keep us modestly aware of how much that seemed like knowledge isn't knowledge.
Could you give some illustrations of the sort of subjects which have been speculated about and then produce the material result later?
Yes, it's quite easy to do so, especially from Greek philosophy. The Greeks invented a whole lot of hypotheses which turned out valuable later, but which in their day couldn't be tested. Take, for example, the atomic hypothesis. Democritus invented the atomic hypothesis that matter consists of little atoms. And after about 2,000 years, and rather more than that, it turned out that this was the right scientific view. But in his day, it was merely a suggestion. Or take again Aristarchus. Aristarchus was the first person who suggested that the Earth went round the sun and not the sun round the Earth, and that the apparent revolution of the heavens every day was due to the Earth rotating. And that remained an almost buried and forgotten hypothesis until the time of Copernicus 2,000 years later. But Copernicus would probably never have thought of it if it hadn't been for Aristarchus.
How is this done? By some sort of intuition?
Oh, no, because the people who first think of these hypotheses can't say this is the truth. They can only say this may be the truth. And if you have a good scientific imagination, you can think of all sorts of things that might be true. And that's the essence of science. You first think of something that might be true, and then you look to see whether it is, and generally it isn't.
But didn't Plato think that Democritus oughtn't to be speculating in this way at all?
Oh, yes. Plato was horrified by him, said all his books ought to be burnt, because Plato didn't like science. He liked mathematics, but he didn't like anything else that was scientific.
But now, in this way, philosophy, in a sense, becomes a kind of servant of science.
Well, that's part of it. But, of course, it isn't only a servant of science, because there are a number of things that science can't deal with. All questions of values, for example. Science won't tell you what is good and what is bad. Tell you what is good or bad as an end, not just as a means.
But what change has there been over the years in the attitude of philosophers and the public to philosophy, would you say?
Well, that depends upon the school of philosophy that you're thinking of. Plato and in Aristotle, both of them, the main thing was an attempt to understand the world. And that, I should say, personally, is what philosophy ought to be doing. But then you come on to the Stoics, and their emphasis was mainly on morality, that you ought to be stoical, you ought to endure misfortunes patiently. And that came to be the popular use of a philosopher.
Would you say that Marx was a philosopher?
Well, he was certainly in a sense a philosopher. But now there you have an important division among philosophers. There are some philosophers who exist to uphold the status quo, and others who exist to upset it. And Marx, of course, belongs to the second lot. For my part, I should reject both those as being not the true business of a philosopher. And I should say the business of a philosopher is not to change the world, but to understand it, which is the exact opposite of what Marx said.
What kind of a philosopher would you say that you are?
Well, the only label I've ever given myself is logical atomist, but I'm not very keen on the label. I've rather avoided labels. It means, in my mind, that the way to get at the nature of any subject matter you're looking at is analysis, and that you can analyze until you get to things that can't be analyzed any further. And those would be logical atoms. I call them logical atoms because they're not little bits of matter. They're the, so to speak, ideas out of which a thing is built up.
What is the main trend of philosophy today?
In what I was saying a moment ago, it would appear that philosophy is merely incomplete science. And there are people who don't like that view. They want to have science have a sphere, philosophy have a sphere to itself. That has led them into what you may call linguistic philosophy. That the important thing for the philosopher is not to answer questions, but to get the meaning of the questions quite clear. I can't myself agree to that view, but I could give an illustration. I was once bicycling to Winchester, and I lost my way, and I went to a village shop, and I said, can you tell me the shortest way to Winchester? And the man I asked called to a man in a back region whom I couldn't see. Gentleman wants to know the shortest way to Winchester. And the voice came back, Winchester? Aye. Way to Winchester? Aye. Shortest way? Aye. Don't know. And so I had to go on without getting an answer. Well, that is what Oxford philosophy thinks one should do. The continental approach is, it's more full-blooded. I don't agree with it anymore. But in a sense, it's much more full-blooded and much more like philosophies of earlier times. There are various kinds. There's the philosophy that comes from Kierkegaard, existentialism. And then there are philosophies designed to provide apologetics for traditional religion. There are various things of that sort. I don't think myself that there's anything very important in all that.
But now, what practical use is your sort of philosophy to a man who wants to know how to conduct himself?
Well, I find it useful because I get letters very often from people saying I'm completely perplexed, I don't know what to do, and I can't see a reason for doing this rather than that. Well, I say to these people, now, this world is not one in which certainty is possible. If you think you've achieved certainty, you're almost certainly mistaken. That's one of the few things you can be certain about. And therefore you have to learn to act upon something that you still more or less doubt. You have to learn to act on probabilities. After all, there's nothing very new about that. Suppose you're a general preparing a plan for a battle. You don't know exactly what the enemy will do. You guess. And if you're a good general, you guess right. If you're a bad general, you guess wrong. But one has, in practical life, to act upon probabilities. And what I should look to philosophy to do is to encourage people to act with vigor without complete certainty.
Yes, but now, how about this business, though, of making people so uncertain about things they'd sort of believed and had faith in? Doesn't that rather disturb them?
Well, it does for a time, of course. And I think a certain amount of disturbance is an essential part of mental training. But if they have any knowledge of science, they get a ballast which enables them to avoid being completely upset by the doubts that they ought to feel.
So what sort of future would you think that philosophy has got? I mean, is it going to run out?
Yes, I don't think philosophy can in the future have anything like the importance that it had either to the Greeks or in the Middle Ages. I think the rise of science inevitably diminishes the importance of philosophy.
But how would you then summarize the value of philosophy in the present world and in the future?
Well, I think it's very important in the present world, first, because, as I say, it keeps you realizing that there are very big and very important questions that science, at any rate at present, can't deal with, and that a scientific attitude by itself is not adequate. And the second thing it does is to make people a little more modest intellectually and aware that a great many things which have been thought certain turned out to be untrue, and that there's no shortcut to knowledge, and that the understanding of the world, which to my mind is the underlying purpose that every philosopher should have, that is a very long and difficult business about which we ought not to be dogmatic.
Have you ever had religious impulses, Lord Russell?
Oh, yes. When I was adolescent, I was deeply religious. I was more interested in religion than in anything else, except perhaps mathematics. And being interested in religion led me, which it doesn't seem often to do, to look into the question whether there was reason to believe it. I took up three questions. It seemed to me that God and immortality and free will were the three most essential questions. And I examined these one by one in the reverse order, beginning with free will. And gradually, I came to the conclusion that there was no reason to believe any of these. And I thought I was going to be very disappointed, but oddly enough, I wasn't.
But how did you come to convince yourself there was no reason to believe in any of these three things?
Well, over free will, I think the argument was not a valid one. And I don't any longer think it was at all conclusive, but I thought that because I thought that all the motions of matter are determined by the laws of dynamics, and the motion of a man's lips when he speaks must be so determined so that he can have no control over what he's going to say. I don't think that was a valid argument, but that convinced me at that time. About immortality, well, it seemed to me quite clear that the relation of body and mind, whatever it may be, is much more intimate than is commonly supposed, and that there's no reason to think that a mind persists when a brain decays. And as for God, well, there are a great many arguments that have been advanced in favor of the existence of God, and one and all, I thought and still think, that they're invalid, and that nobody would have accepted such arguments if they hadn't wanted to believe the conclusion.
Do you think that it is certain that there is no such thing as God, or simply that it is not proven?
I don't think it is certain that there is no such thing. No, I think that it is on exactly the same level as the Olympic gods or the Norwegian gods. They also may exist, the gods of Olympus and the gods of Valhalla. I can't prove they don't. But I think the Christian God has no more likelihood than they have. I think they're a bare possibility.
Do you think that religion is good or harmful in its effects?
I think most of its effects in history have been harmful. Not all. Religion caused the Egyptian priests to fix the calendar and to note the occurrence of eclipses so well that in time they were able to predict them. I think those were beneficial effects of religion. But I think the great majority have been bad, and I think they've been bad because it was held important that people should believe something for which there did not exist good evidence. And that falsified everybody's thinking, falsified systems of education, and set up also what I think a complete moral heresy, namely that it is right to believe certain things and wrong to believe certain others, apart from the question whether the things in question are true or false.
But do you mean there's a kind of censorship of thought that goes on, which prevents free thinking?
I do, yes. I mean, if you take practically any school in the world, any school for boys and girls, you will find that a certain kind of belief is taught. It's one sort in Christian countries and another in communist countries. But in both, something is taught, and the evidence for what is taught is not impartially examined, and the children are not encouraged to find out what there is to say on the other side.
Well, what is it that makes man over the centuries demand a religion?
I think mainly fear. Man feels himself rather powerless. There are three things that cause him fear. One is what nature can do to him. It can strike him by lightning or swallow him up in an earthquake. One is what other men can do, which is that they can kill him in war. And the third, which has a great deal to do with religion, is what his own violent passions may lead him to do, the things which he knows in a calm moment he would regret having done. And for that reason, most people have a great deal of fear in their lives, and religion helps them to be not so frightened by these fears. But the founders of religions, I say religions in the plural, have very little to do with what their followers teach. Very little indeed. To take an illustration, I've found that military men in this country think that Christian belief is very important in the contest with Eastern powers. And they think that if you're not a Christian, you won't be so vigorous about it. Well, I read the Sermon on the Mount over again, and I couldn't find a word in it to encourage H-bombs, not a word.
Much of what you're criticizing happened a long time ago, but what about today?
Oh, no, it's just the same today. This illustration I gave you about the H-bombs is certainly not antiquated yet. I wish it were. And I think that at this present day, religion, as embodied in the churches, in the main discourages honest thinking and gives importance to things that are not very important. Its sense of importance seems to be quite wrong. Now, when the Roman Empire was falling, the fathers of the church didn't bother much with the fall of the Roman Empire. What they bothered with was how to preserve virginity. That was what they thought important. Well, now...
What did they do about that, sir?
Well, they exhorted people and didn't bother about you seeing that the armies held the frontiers or anything like that, or that the taxation system was reformed. They were occupied in founding monasteries and nunneries and so forth, and thought that far more important than preserving the empire. Well, so in the present day, when the human race is falling, I find that eminent divines think that it's much more important to prevent artificial insemination than it is to prevent the kind of world war that will exterminate the whole lot of us. And that seems to me to show a lack of sense of proportion.
Yes, wouldn't you agree, though, that many organized religions have done a tremendous amount of good in spreading education where perhaps no other system has been available, as in Burma, say, where the monks have done a tremendous amount of educating the poor, where there aren't any organized schools?
Well, I think it's possible, yes, and I think the Benedictines did a certain amount of good in that way. But only after doing the harm. They first did a great deal of harm, and then a little good.
But then what about people, though, who feel they must have some faith in a religion, otherwise they can't face their life at all?
Well,
you take that away.
I say people who feel that are really, they're showing a kind of cowardice, which in any other sphere would be considered contemptible. But when it's in the religious sphere, it's thought admirable. And I can't admire cowardice, whatever sphere it's in. Now, take the whole question of the very dangerous condition that the world is in. I get letters constantly from people saying, oh, God will look after it. But he never has in the past. I don't know why they should think he will in the future.
You think this is a very unwise doctrine to follow. It ought to be self-help rather than depending on somebody else to do it for you.
Certainly, yes.
But then if, though, a religion is harmful, and yet man has always insisted on having one, what is the answer?
Oh, man hasn't. Some men have, and those are the men who are used to it. In countries, in the land, for instance, people walk on stilts, and they don't like walking without stilts. And religion is just the same thing. Some countries have got accustomed to it. But now, I spent a year in China, and I found that the ordinary, average Chinese had no religion whatsoever, and they were just as happy, I think, given their bad circumstances, happier than most Christians would have been.
Well, I think a Christian would say that if he could convert them into being Christians, they'd be much happier.
Well, I don't think that's borne out by the evidence at all.
Yes, but now, doesn't man rather search for some cause or faith outside himself, which appears to be bigger than himself, not merely a question of cowardice or leaning on it, but also wanting to do something for it?
Well, but there are plenty of things bigger than oneself. I mean, you start, first of all, there's your family, then there's your nation, then there's mankind in general. Those are all bigger than oneself and are quite sufficient to occupy any genuine feelings of benevolence that a man may have.
Do you think that organized religion is going to go on having the same grip on mankind?
I think it depends entirely upon whether people solve their social problems or not. I think that if there go on being great wars and great oppressions and many people leading very unhappy lives, probably religion will go on, because I've observed that the belief in the goodness of God is inversely proportional to the evidence. When there's no evidence for it at all, people believe it. And when things are going well and you might believe it, they don't. So I think that if people solve their social problems, religion will die out. But on the other hand, if they don't, I don't think it will. Now, you can get illustrations of that in the past. In the 18th century, when things were quiet, a great many educated people were free thinkers. Well, then came the French Revolution, and certainly English aristocrats came to the conclusion that free thought led to the guillotine, and so they dropped it, and they all became deeply religious, and you got Victorianism. And the same thing again happened with the Russian Revolution. The Russian Revolution terrified people, and they thought that unless they believed in God, their property would be confiscated. So they believed in him. So that I think you'll find that these social upheavals are very good for religion.
But do you think that you and I are going to be just snuffed out completely when we die?
Certainly, yes. I don't see why you... What, I mean, I know that the body disintegrates, and I think that there's no reason whatever to suppose that the mind goes on when the body is disintegrated.